Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time Olympics spectator.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that faces peril of the emotional sort only when theaters run out of our favorite treats. That said, we appreciate movies that put their protagonists in perilous situations, which has been a staple of fiction at least since the time of the Greeks. Speaking of classics, we'll begin with Wuthering Heights, Emerald Fennell's adaptation of Emily Bronte's 1847 novel about a torrid, gothic love affair with social commentary overtones. Then we'll transition to Gore Verbinski's rabid look at a possible future, one involving the specter of artificial intelligence, bearing the inviting title, Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die. Let's begin with an adaptation or reinterpretation of one of the great works of British literature. Calling what writer-director Fennell has put on the screen a reinterpretation is her own description. The work in question is Emily Bronte's 1847 novel, Wuthering Heights. The story, by now, is familiar to most readers and or movie fans, detailing the long-suppressed and ultimately tragic love affair between the upper-class Catherine Earnshaw and the adopted wastrel she dubs Heathcliff. Margot Robbie and Jacob Elordi, as Kathy and Heathcliff, have given good performances, respectively, in such films as Barbie and last year's Frankenstein. Here, though, they are more than a tad too contemporary to be believable as 19th century characters. Writer-director Fennell, whose previous features, Promising Young Woman and Saltburn, earned her at least a measure of critical acclaim, adopts here an almost Grand Guignol-type atmosphere mixed with an overbearing musical score. The result is that of the many adaptations of the novel that have been made over the decades, including the famous 1939 William Wyler-directed feature starring Laurence Olivier and Merle Oberon, Fennell's version may be the most over-the-top. The impressively moody computer graphic enhanced visuals of the weathered estate of the film's title vies with sweeping views of the haunted, fog-shrouded Yorkshire moors. But all of us is in service to a Fennell imagined tale that, sadly enough, feels like an overheated Harlequin romance weeper.
Well, I'm going to begin this, first of all, by saying, Dan, you stole a little bit of my thunder in your overview, but I'm hoping that some of what we discuss here might be characterized as fighting words, but in a good way, because even though I thought this film was a miss in nearly every way, that does not mean that you shouldn't see it and form your own opinion, because this is one of these films that has been more divisive than almost anything I can remember in the relative recent past. First of all, it's, quote, Wuthering Heights, end quote. So that tells you something. As you pointed out, it's a reinterpretation. I am not by any means a Bronte purist, and much of the controversy has stemmed from that. So people are going back to the novel, looking at all the different ways that the spirit of the novel, the facts of the novel, everything has been either put aside, reinterpreted, reimagined in some way that they object to. And I think that some of the things that were changed from the novel, I mean, all of these ongoing themes of racism and classism and colonialism are sort of there, but not, in a more overt way. I think my recollection from the novel is that Kathy's dad, I didn't think he was a mean dude in the book at all. And here he's pretty horrific in terms of his parenting ability. I think a lot of the controversy, focused on Heathcliff, because in the book it's clear that he's described as a dark-skinned fellow. And so we don't know if he's Roma, or maybe some have speculated that he was Irish and he was just not English. So that's part of it. The other controversy is this reinterpretation, reimagination tells only half the story and ends in a very different way than anything that we see in the novel. Dan, in your intro, you talked about Margot Robbie and Jacob Elordi being too contemporary. I think when I was saying something, I said, Margot Robbie is too much of an American girl. And then you pointed out, oh, she's Australian, as is Jacob Elordi. So I had to back off that description. But I did not buy her in any way as any sort of 19th century heroine. and him, that wig was so awful. I just wanted to rip it off of his head, you know, at various points throughout my viewing. The most important thing was this has been described as sort of soft porn or something. And I didn't see that there was any chemistry between the two main characters. If you want chemistry,
people need to get a grip.
They need to watch.
Good Lord.
They need to watch Heated Rivalry. I'm sorry, the series with the two gay hockey players. You know, there's this whole BDSM sequence involving the next door neighbor and Heathcliff and so forth. Why? I'm not sure. There are a few things I did like about the film. I thought the overall production design was good. There is some excellent cinematography. But this is coming from someone who, perhaps ironically, liked Emerald Fennell's first two films. I like both Saltburn and Promising Young Woman, mainly because of the lead performances in Promising Young Woman by Carey Mulligan, in Saltburn by Barry Keoghan. But yeah, this just did not work for me in any way. And Dan and I actually guffawed a couple of times during the movie, and it might have been a little inappropriate, just saying.
Well, most of my knowledge of Wuthering Heights comes not from the novel, which I haven't read, but from some of the other film versions, and of course the Kate Bush song, which this movie could have used more Kate Bush. Well, it doesn't
rather
have
than
any
Charlie.
Charlie XCX is just fine, but she's no Kate Bush. So I don't have the connection to the source material that it feels like some people who are criticizing the movie do, and I understand that it only, you know, glancingly resembles the text. And I'm all for radical reinterpretations of classic literature.
But Shakespeare in particular.
Watching this, I just didn't understand why she wanted to adapt Wuthering Heights in the first place. I mean, her movies, at least the three that she has written and directed, they've all included these shocking and button-pushing themes. And here we get all of those things that you mentioned. And from the very first frame, there's a deliberate merging of sex and death.
Yes.
Feels like she's trying to channel Ken Russell or somebody like that. But she doesn't explore any of those themes beyond just provocation.
Putting
it's
it
like
out there, right.
She drops them and then runs away from them. They're like set decoration. And as I have gleaned from just kind of knowing about the book, I understand that it's even more twisted and morbid than this version is, and that the cruelty and the hostility of the characters extends not only beyond the grave, but into the next generation.
Yes.
To Kathy and Heathcliff's children. So what are we even doing here with this movie? It has this veneer of transgressiveness, but it doesn't commit to any of its edgy ideas. It doesn't push them. And so I'm with you. I thought this was pretty much unbearable. And another glaring problem. I agree. Margot Robbie, I don't think she's right for this part at all. In the early scenes, Kathy's supposed to be like an annoying teenager or maybe an early 20-something. And Robbie, who I've loved in pretty much everything else,
yeah.
Is
Me too.
So unconvincing that I wondered if her casting was like some kind of meta joke. But I think it's just the case of, you know, an extremely bankable star
right.
being put in there to get people in the theater. And, you know, she worked with Emerald Fennell on Barbie. Alordi is fine, but I'm with you. They don't have any chemistry, not romantic, not volatile, not really anything.
And even Hong Chau, who I've appreciated. So she plays Kathy's companion, a domestic servant, Nellie.
A companion, yeah.
Yeah. And I've liked her in other things. And she just has this furrowed brow throughout the entire
yeah.
film. And they didn't really give her enough to do, given the level of her talent, too.
Martin Clunes, I thought his performance was probably the best in the film.
Yeah,
he
he's good.
He plays Kathy's, or as Laurence Olivier would have said it, Kathy. He plays Kathy's father, who's a drunk and a gambler. And I thought he put in a pretty good performance. But if I'm saying that's the best thing about Wuthering Heights, that's not saying much at all.
Well, and, you know, you have these two characters who... Okay, well, for the sake of the movie, we'll say, sure, they're in love, even though I know in the novel it's more complicated than that. They keep saying they're in love. They keep saying their passion burns like a thousand suns. They say it, and they say it, and we don't feel it at all. We don't understand who these people are. And there's so many montages of them wandering across the moors and those Charlie XCX songs are playing. And it looked and sounded like a music video. Mm-hmm. And so if all you're going to for this movie is aesthetics, it's like, well, then why does it have to be Wuthering Heights? I don't know. I just, this movie felt so empty to me, and yet it was like, it didn't go far enough. Like, it's, yeah. You keep hearing how, you know, shocking, and to say that it's anything like, you know, pornographic is a joke, there's barely any sex in this movie anyway. So, I agree. This is a total mess.
Despite some good cinematography, maybe it looked good as a concept, but no. But you decide for yourself.
Hey, if I'm going to watch a movie with a bunch of sad people in bright red rooms, I'll just watch Cries and Whispers again. Am I right?
There we go. Anyway, that was our discussion of Wuthering Heights. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to address Gore Verbinski's Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
As a public radio fan, you often hear that we're supported by listeners like you. We say it all the time because it's the truth. Continual support from our community keeps us going. You can give back by starting a sustaining membership, a recurring monthly donation to SPR. Giving $10 to $20 a month is a great way to support our station. To begin your membership, visit SpokanePublicRadio.org and look for the red donate button. Thanks.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed Emerald Fennell's adaptation of Emily Bronte's novel, Wuthering Heights. Let's now move to something madcap. Gore Verbinski's manic time travel quest bearing the intriguing title, Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die. With that kind of title, you'd be right in thinking that director Verbinski's film is a bizarre stretch of the imagination. In fact, it's so bizarre, it resists any simple description. Suffice it to say that Sam Rockwell plays a character who, dressed like a street person on steroids, shows up one night at a Los Angeles eatery and shocks the patrons by claiming to be from the future and that he needs volunteers to go with them on a mission to do nothing less than save humankind. This is, he says, the 117th time he's embarked on this mission, and he has little information to give his newly conscripted charges other than what's inferred from the film's title. From there, riding Rockwell's trademark frenetic energy as he works off Matthew Robinson's screenplay, Verbinski takes us on a time travel tale that presages the dangers of artificial intelligence. The result is amusing, though as wild as the film is, it's not, in the end, quite as daring or original a project as Verbinski and company seem to think.
Well, Gore Verbinski has directed both live action and animation. You know, he did the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. He did Rango. He did
the American version of The Ring.
Yeah. And this movie feels like it kind of has one foot in animation and one foot in live action. And I think it most closely resembles his debut film, which was called Mouse Hunt. And I think Madcap and Manic are both perfect descriptors for this movie. Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die. It has a lot of clever ideas in it, but I felt like for every clever idea, there were at least two that I didn't think were very clever. The first half of this movie is pretty effective. That opening in the diner has an elasticity and a pacing that I think matches the best of Verbinski's work. And his work is all over the place, let's say that. And we get then these amusing standalone chapters about each of the characters who join Rockwell's party, and each of these chapters sort of dealing with a very contemporary technological issue. And one of them, starring Juno Temple, that I don't want to spoil, all the way at least, involves America's response to gun violence. And it's so bold and shocking, especially in a movie like this, and somehow still very cutting and funny, that it felt like a little bit of satire in the middle of a movie that I didn't really expect to be satirical. But in classic Gore Verbinski fashion, this movie just gets flabbier and more overstuffed as it goes along. There's a 30-minute chunk kind of in the middle, near the end, where the characters are running around this neighborhood. And it's so tedious, and it's filmed in a way that's kind of hard to see. And so ultimately, I think this movie does have more ideas than it does have an actual coherent story, really. But I have to say that I'm happy to see Verbinski back, because this is so obviously a Gore Verbinski film, and he pops up in a little cameo near the beginning, too. I went, oh, there he is. And so, you know, I admire the vision here, even if it only works about, I don't want to say half the time, it's a little more than half. Your mileage may vary is what I'm trying to say.
We saw, and so at the Palm Springs International Film Festival, they have this film montage that screens before each of the feature films. And so we saw the scene with Sam Rockwell in the diner probably, well, in your
26
times. And so I
That's almost as many times as he came back from the future.
Correct. So I was actually pleased to put this all together. Of course, we have Sam Rockwell, and I almost always love him.
Yep.
In any performance that he does, going
Galaxy Quest.
Yep, Galaxy Quest for sure. And most recently, we saw him in White Lotus, and he delivers this monologue that is like so out there.
Oh, yeah.
That we could not barely believe it. But the other characters in this film, I mean, they are A-list actors, at least in large part. So we have Juno Temple, who I've always appreciated, and she's the bereaved mother to whom you alluded. Michael Pena and Zazie Beetz, who are teachers. We have Asim Chaudhry and Daniel Barrett, Georgia Goodman. But my favorite character in this film was played by Haley Lou Richardson. One thing that you maybe sort of glided over in your introduction is they know, or at least the Sam Rockwell character knows, that a child is going to be responsible for creating artificial intelligence. And so they're trying to seek out this kid and sort of stop the inevitable downfall of the universe or
something. It's basically the plot of Terminator 2 Judgment Day.
Yes, it is. But I agree with you totally, despite the talent of the actors. It was sort of up and down, because there were some really good aspects to this. And then there was just sort of this lag in the middle. But I did like Haley Lou Richardson, who plays a character who's allergic, as improbable as it might seem, to technology. And her boyfriend becomes hooked on VR. And as a result, she, you know, is sort of left traversing the world in an aimless fashion. And that's what we find out in these backstories. All of these people had a reason for wanting to go with this person who seems to be possibly in the throes of an acute psychotic episode.
And some of them had gone with him in
apparently,
one of the 116 times previously.
Yeah, he's tried like different formations of people every time. Yeah.
See, unlike you, I thought that the first half was far better than the second half.
And oh, yeah.
When they get in the neighborhood, as you pointed out, Nathan, and they're running around and they're zombies and zebras and
it
whatever.
It looked like a scavenger hunt or something.
Exactly. But then the ultimate climax, and I'm not going to give it away, it reminded me of the latest It variation starring Bill Skarsgård of the Stephen King novel with, you know, the way it ends. And I went, well, that's nothing new. I love the fact that you pointed out the Juno Temple one about gun violence, because that reminded me of that could have been a Twilight Zone segment.
Yeah, or like
a
Stephen King short story
exactly.
or something. Yeah.
I'd love to see a whole movie about that.
Well, I said to my friend after we left the movie, I said, that was like watching an entire season of the show Black Mirror, but on double speed.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and this is an issue we've talked about with movies that are trying to capture the flavor of the times, is that because there's so much going on and we're so hyper aware of so many things, this movie has to bite off a lot and it can't chew all of it, because it's dealing with AI, it's dealing with VR, it's dealing with social media, phone addiction. Again, some of it is really clever. And then the stuff with like, hey, have you ever noticed that teenagers are like zombies when they're on their phones? I mean, that's tired stuff, right? But it's in the middle of not so tired stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of come out with this stew of kind of ingredients that maybe don't totally go together, but there are moments when they do go together. And the movie works.
And I really like the beginning, as you noted, in terms of, so it takes place in Norm's Diner. And so we have this character sort of burst in and disrupt people's conversations and activities. And I thought that Verbinski did a really good job of focusing on different people, because some people are just like befuddled and some people are look terrified and other people are just ignoring, you know, what's happening. And it just there was something about it that felt like authentic reaction. Well,
and there's the one character. There was one character who raises his hand, and the Sam Rockwell character goes, "No, no, you're not going.
Yeah, you're useless." Yeah. Well, and that sequence also, I think, has the most inventive cinematography.
Yeah,
like there's one shot in particular where he's filming Sam Rockwell through a woman's glasses, and I thought that's the kind of visual imagination that I expect from Verbinski. And we should say that Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die is his first feature in, I think, a decade. Yeah. His last was that gothic horror film, A Cure for Wellness. That movie was also very visually inventive, very tonally all over the place. I think ultimately it had way too much going on in it. And I think all of those traits apply to this movie, too. And A Cure for Wellness, like this movie, got a lot of mixed reviews in its initial run, didn't do very much box office. But it's kind of developed a little cult following as time has gone on. And I wouldn't be surprised if this movie follows the same trajectory.
I agree with that. I mean, I just heard a segment on National Public Radio about return to the video stores and, you know, how people are seeking out these sort of quirky films from a while ago. And this could definitely fall into that category, because when you look through everything that happens here, it doesn't all work. But when it does, I was entertained.
Yeah. So are we going to have a second chapter of Scarecrow Video? Is that going to come back?
Well, Scarecrow is still around and thriving, and I rent from them all the time. They have to send it to me in the mail. But hey, if you don't know Scarecrow Video, check it out. And they'll probably have this
Seattle
in their
based.
Yeah, they'll probably have this in their stock in a few months' time. Probably. Maybe people will find it there.
The title's a little unwieldy, gotta say. Good luck,
a
have
little.
Fun, don't die.
That was our discussion of Gore Verbinski's crazed and chaotic feature, Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die. And this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbend and Mary Pat Truthart and I discussed Emerald Fennell's adaptation, or reinterpretation in her words, of Emily Bronte's novel, Wuthering Heights. Let's take this moment to thank Aaron Bratt for directing the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer, wherever we can find it. Until then, consider these words from the actor Nick Offerman. In a time when truth is very much in peril, books remain the ultimate repository of creative ideas and irreplaceable knowledge. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.